You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate
and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world.
And now, innovation thought leader
and your super fly host,
Tamara Kleinberg.
Hey, Launch Streeters. Just had a fantastic interview with Lisa Bodell. I think you're going to really appreciate this and get a lot out of it, both personally and professionally. I know I did. Lisa Bodell is the CEO of Future Think and the best-selling author of Kill the Company and her latest book, Why Simple Wins. She is recognized as a global leader on innovation, foresight, and change management, whose keynotes leave audiences inspired with a vision and armed with the tools towards action. Her new book and keynote, Why Simple Wins, Escape from Complexity Trap and Get to the Work That Matters, is a sought-after topic. And after this conversation, I think you will absolutely understand why. She has worked with organizations ranging from Google and Cisco and Citigroup to Merck, Fidelity, Accenture, U.S. Navy. She's been featured in Fast Company, Wired, New York Times, Bloomberg, Business Week, Forbes, Harvard Business Review. The list goes on and on. She is that good. There's a couple things I want you to listen for in this interview. We dig deep into simplification and what that really means. Not just how do you get rid of a to-do list, but how do you truly simplify your work and life? We talked a little bit about the difference between mundane versus mission work and how getting out of the mundane and into mission work not only helps you innovate, but it helps you get energized and enthusiastic about the things that you do every single day. She even gave us a little tea tool around it, which I am, the minute I'm done with this recording, about to hit hard and see if I'm doing mission or mundane work. We talked a little bit about becoming your own chief simplification officer, what that means, how to do it, again, in your work and in your life as well, which is so important. And we talked about how to have the courage and to get over the fear to do things like say no and kill the complexity, as she talks about, and challenge those assumptions that are causing unnecessary work and busyness in your life. Like I said, I got a ton out of this interview. I took copious notes. I think that you will as well. Lisa, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to dig in, so we're just going to go for it. I've been following you for the last couple of years. I think you and I connected, I think it was a couple of years ago now.
Yeah.
And I've been watching you kind of out there talking about simplification and the power of it. So talk a little bit about, let's get a little grounded. Where does that passion come from and what does that even mean?
I have to say, the passion for simplification and writing this latest book really is one of those physician heal thyself kind of moments. And, you know, I write books out of things that I want to solve for myself, and simplification was definitely one of them. You know, I've always prided myself on someone who's been very effective and efficient and organized, and I can multitask with the best of them. And I'm sure you can too, right? We become high functioning people the older we get. And I have to tell you, though, I couldn't figure out why I still felt like I wasn't getting anything done and I wasn't satisfied. And I mean that, frankly, in terms of both work and personal life. And so I started to think about, like, what is wrong with me? I'm so good with time management. And I realized it's not about time management. It's about, am I doing the right things? Am I spending my time on what's valuable? Because I think that's where people get confused, right? They think, well, how do you manage your time? How can you do more with less? And that's the trap we fall into. It's not about doing more. It's actually about doing better. And in fact, it's about saying no to things or doing less so you can spend more time on those better, more valuable things. So the passion for it came from me trying to solve my own problem of how can I actually figure out the tips and the tricks from the best to focus my time on having more free time and getting rid of the crap that was weighing me down. And that took a while to do.
Let me ask you about that, because as you're sitting there, I'm laughing at my to-do list on my desk, which is so long that I can't even see the end of it.
Well, that's good.
As I check things off, I feel really accomplished. But at the flip side, I don't always move the needle forward, just in all honesty, right? I think that's kind of what you're saying. So how do you know that the things that you're doing are those, as you said, the right things?
Well, so let me tell you about that, because you asked about defining it. And I laugh with people when I give my keynote talks on simplification, which, by the way, I have to tell you this little anecdote. I tell people, they asked me, how is this topic now that you're focusing on different than the stuff you focused on in the past, like futuring and innovation? And that's really, you know, my background. And I said, here's the difference of how I know I've really struck a nerve. When I used to get off stage talking about innovation or future trends, people would, they'd want to ask me more questions. They were very interested. Now, when I got off stage talking about, you know, killing complexity or focusing on simplicity, they'd literally want to hug me and tackle me like a therapist. You know,
like, that's a big difference.
It's a huge inappropriate difference, right? It's almost like they love me. They want to be with me. They want me to just move into their home and help them. And so it's an emotional thing. It's much more emotional because it's so personal, right? So
yeah,
one of the stories I talk about in my keynotes is I say how, listen, I am one of these people that when I get stuff done, I love the satisfaction of a to-do list so much that even if I didn't have a list, I will create a list.
Just to mark stuff off.
Just to cross, right? You're that person too.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone in the audience laughs because you know people love it. But that's, it's not about time management. It's are you spending your time on the right thing. So here's a simple thing I tell people to do, and you should try this, which is literally put a T-chart on a piece of paper. And on the left-hand side, it's what you do. And on the right-hand side, it's what you'd like to do. So what you do is basically breaking your day or your week. I don't think a day is accurate, a week down into parts. So what do you spend your week doing? And you can either use your own diary or Outlook calendar, or just jot things down from memory and look at what you spend your time on. And be specific, right? It can be, you know, monthly meetings, it can be ongoing sales reports, it can be client calls, it can be responding to emails. Bonus points if you can put time or hours next to these things. Mm. Once you do that, then pause. And being very honest with yourself, circle the ones that you feel like help you meet your work or your life goals, depending on if you're doing this for work or personal. Here's what you find. You circle very few things.
Right.
You do.
Right.
And people laugh, you know, and it's the stuff you spend your time on are the mundane tasks. They're the things that we put in place to manage the rest of our life, like meetings, reports, policies, procedures, emails, all crap, basically. And a lot of it isn't necessary. We create unnecessary self-imposed work. And when you look at your list of stuff, you realize, huh, I'm spending my time on stuff that doesn't really matter. Well, that's one piece, right? Because then that shows you, here's the stuff I can get rid of, the stuff that's not circled. Here's the stuff circled that I think is more towards my goals. Why is that? And then you move to the right-hand side of your T-chart, and that's what do you wish you could spend your time on? And here's what's interesting. It will be harder for you to fill out that side of the chart because most people are so drowning in the left-hand side, they don't even know anymore what they should put on the right-hand side.
Wow.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, that was another thing about this whole simplification effort. It was really more about killing complexity than it was about finding simplicity, because until you kill the complexity, you won't even have the mindset to be able to figure out what is the work that matters. What do I want to be able to do once I have that time? And when we go into companies, we find out that a lot of people have become paralyzed. When they do have the time, they don't know what to do anymore. So both sides of that T-chart are really important, so you actually know what you want to be working towards.
So how do you know when you go into an organization? I know you do a lot of work with Fortune 500 and kind of big name companies and ones that really need the help moving forward. And like you said, you have you're steeped in innovation as well. How do you know when you go into an organization that that knot of yarn is so tangled and complex?
Well, it's easy because you actually talk to people about what do they spend their day doing. And then you talk to them about what do they wish they were doing. And that alone is the left-hand side is it's the tactical, the mundane, it's very task-oriented versus the right-hand side is very visionary, emotional, and inspiring. And so you get a feel for the culture right away. And when you ask people what they spend their time doing and does it get them to their goals and they say no, that right there is the knot. But what is the surprising part is they don't realize that they are the ones that are causing the problem. So this is kind of the interesting thing you learn about complexity is everyone thinks everyone else is the problem.
It's them. It's all
them. And sometimes
them.
It is, because if it's your boss and your boss is imposing on you meetings, emails, okay, then it's hard to fight back because you don't have a culture where you're allowed to say no. You have a culture where there are false deadlines. You know the culture is driven by risk, fear, power, and control. Those are the real drivers of complexity and why people can't get simplified. And when we look at people's daily work, we can pretty quickly understand what they self-impose as well as what they are allowed to do. And both those things are important because self-imposed is saying, I can't do this. But the other thing in terms of empowerment is the bigger piece that lets it stick for the long term. Does the boss let you indeed say no?
So how does this impact innovation? I have to imagine that just the complexity itself. And then the flip side of that is when you get to simplification. What's that
direct
impact look like?
And this is funny. I wrote this book because I couldn't figure out why from my last book. You know, I run an innovation company. And I wrote this book. My previous one was called Kill the Company. And it was about how do you get rid of the bad work so you can start doing the good innovative work? And what was interesting was people had a desire to innovate. I mean, that's not a question. I couldn't figure out why they weren't doing it. And the reason why is they couldn't get to it. They were drowning in mundane work. You know, sure, they'd love to brainstorm. Sure, they'd love to do customer-centric innovation just as soon as meetings and emails were done. So I realized that it doesn't really matter how much we talk about innovation because we can't get to it. We have to start being more subtractive and get rid of the stuff that's not working, do that spring cleaning as part of our process so we can have the space for real thinking and innovation to occur. We're not doing the real front end of this process, so all this talk about innovation really is kind of wasting time.
Right, so at 5 p.m., maybe if I have the energy. Yeah. If I'm lucky, I'll get to it.
And the problem really is just what you said. When they do find the time, they don't have the energy. So, you know, we want the innovative cultures, right? We want inspiring workplaces. But what people really want first is inspiring work. So if you can get me inspiring work first and concentrate on that, then I'll be able to do more innovative, inspiring things.
So one of the things that you said in your most recent TED Talk, and we'll put the link in our show notes too for everyone so they can go see it because it's absolutely phenomenal. But you said something that really, I actually had to stop it, reverse it, and listen to it again because I just wanted to make sure I heard it right. I thought it was so powerful. You said that thinking has become a daring act. Talk a little bit about that.
I'm so glad you caught that because I feel like this gets into that complexity trap. We are so addicted to doing that we have a hard time even when we do find the space to think. And I tell this joke about, you know, you're trying to get things done, right? We rely so much on other people. We're so intertwined that, of course, we do have to all get moving in the same simplicity direction to really make it stick. But we're so busy doing that we're not going to be able to do it. We imagine walking by somebody's office, okay? And there's Bob. He's just looking out the window, smiling. And he's just gazing. And, you're thinking like,
get to work, Bob.
Exactly. And he says, I'm sorry, I was just looking out the window and thinking. And the first reaction everyone has when I talk to, give keynotes is exactly what you just said. Get back to work. Work is not thinking. And that's the problem. Because we believe when we finally do have the time that when we look at others do it, they're wasting time. So we have to recalibrate that what do we spend our time doing equation so thinking can become to the forefront.
I'll never forget, this is years ago when I was actually still employable and working for other people. I got in a world of trouble because I was perusing the internet looking for analogies, ideas outside of our business realm that would help us. And my boss walked by my office and I got in a ton of trouble. I was just kind of thinking through like, hey, how does fitness solve this? How does, music solve this problem? And I had the same response. My boss was like, what are you doing? You shouldn't be doing this on work time. And they just couldn't get it. It was so frustrating to me as the person who kind of, to what you said, I wanted to think and they wanted me to do.
And there's the difference in the culture. But the interesting thing is I bet if we talked more about this, I'm not sure that you were getting the right things done in that office. But there's a difference between, people think that being busy, right, is the best because we put our value in ourselves by being busy. And there's actual currency. And that's a problem because then all we're doing is filling time versus using our time in wise ways. And that creates a culture of busy. It may create a culture even of organized, by the way, but that doesn't create a culture of simplified because busy and organized does not mean simplified at all.
So, this may not matter anymore, but how did we get here? How did we get to that place where coming in at 7 and leaving at 7 and having a huge to-do list became the mark of success or the mark of, working hard and being invested in what you're doing.
And I think when the economy is good, things grow easily, right? And so then we start to talk about how, the busy we are, that must be what's causing this growth. And what the problem, and of course, successful times also hide a lot of warts. They hide people that are weak, that are operating out of fear, that are really doing not valuable tasks, if there's a lot of capital going around in the marketplace, if there's a lot of technology solving problems, that's kind of masking the underlying ambient issue of unproductive workers doing unproductive things. So,
Go ahead. I have so many questions. I mean, Lisa, I want to hug you now, just like the keynote. I'm going to reach over through the phone. I'm going to hug you. So next time I'm in New York, I'm coming over. I'm just coming in for a bear hug.
Sounds good. I'm here.
Do you think that the act, kind of that daring act of thinking, of truly thinking, actually helps with that paralysis and that overanalyzing on the back end? Because I do think with innovation, oftentimes too, I think you're absolutely right. There's this energy and lack of ability to even get to it. Like there's this brick wall between you and the ability to innovate because of what you're talking about with just being busy with unnecessary stuff. And then there's also the flip side that we see, which I'm sure you see too, of, you know, oh my God, you're thinking this to death. And it's never going to go anywhere because you can't get it off paper and into the real world.
That's true, too. Then we'll talk about decision-making. But I think one of the things that I get asked about a lot, and this relates to that kind of data analysis thing, which is, technology. Does technology help or contribute to complexity? You know what I mean? Does it help supply or does it create complexity? The answer is yes. And it does both, right? So it depends on how you use it. It can help you do tasks more quickly. It can get you access to things. That's the good part of simplicity. The problem is human nature. That's really the problem, which is just because you can doesn't mean you should. And we then, why just measure 6 KPIs when you could measure 80 KPIs? And there was a friend who shall not be named at IBM who was working in a sales group. And, they are an amazing company. They have incredible access to technology and data. And she said, here's a great story, Lisa, which every person listening can relate to. We launched a new product and we had 6 KPIs. We wanted to just keep it simple. But then, as the quarter went on, why not measure a couple more things? And then as we got towards the end of the year and it was coming up to performance reviews and managers wanted to look even better, why not manage a few more? And she said, what started as 6 KPIs became 22 KPIs. And the thing that people started focusing on is how can we still fit this report onto one sheet and keep it simple? And she said, we couldn't, we traded the telescope for the microscope, basically, which is we're so focused on, formatting stuff and having the data that we lost sight of what we were trying to accomplish in the first place. And that's the real issue with technology and more and busy is that we lose our focus and we start being internal navel gazers versus external customer solving problems.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a client that had 35 KPIs.
Why?
And my question was very simple, which is, what do these tell you? Just help me understand what they tell you. I don't know your business yet. Help me understand. And really, let's face it, 30 of them didn't matter, really, in terms of progress. So what you're saying is so, it just resonates so much because you're right. We have so much data and now we're just drowning in it and we're making it more complex.
Well, you just said something very interesting. You made me think of a couple things I'd love to talk about, which is one, being extreme and asking questions to really push people to simplify. Because people, it's interesting, they say they want to simplify, but man, they have a hard time letting go. Because remember, we value more. Yeah. That's one of the issues around simplicity. It's one of the myths is that we value more, not less. So everyone gets rewarded for more, for measuring more, and that allows them to, operate with less fear, with risk, having control, etc. So you really need somebody in charge, either a leader, a decision maker, or a partner in crime, a colleague, that will ask the difficult questions. Like you said, tell me what this KPI really means. Tell me how it really is different. What if we didn't? What would happen if we got rid of it? Could we pilot test getting rid of it? Asking those kinds of subtractive questions is really important because people have a fear that they're going to miss something, they're going to get fired. All those kinds of things happen. So you have to be extreme and you have to push, I think, when it comes to simplification. And the one other thing I'll say about what you said is what you did in terms of asking the question, especially if you were the boss, it takes courage. That's a big thing with simplification in terms of the simplicity mindset is having courage because operating with less is difficult for a lot of people. It makes them feel like they're kind of blowing in the wind.
I want to make a little bit of a distinction for listeners out here, because I think what you're talking about is so important, whether you are, you know, low on the totem pole or really high up in the organization or even run your own business. And that is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lisa, but simplicity isn't just about, I mean, I started making fun of the to-do list, but it's really not just about how do I become more, you know, quote unquote, productive in my day. It really is about pulling away the unnecessary complexity in everything that you're doing, not just what you're doing, but what you're looking at and reviewing and how your systems
That's
are
right.
set up.
In fact, you know, there's lots of different kinds of complexity. And you mentioned systems. Frankly, that's a huge deal, right? Because we are the ones that create these systems and we add on to it versus knocking them down and creating something from scratch. It's just easier to do, right? So that's how a lot of things just kind of build up a callus over time. But when you talk to people about complexity, the first thing they say that drives them nuts are things like regulation and the organization. But what really, really, really drives them crazy when you drill down are the everyday things. They are emails, meetings, PowerPoints, decision-making, that kind of stuff. And the good news there is those are things we can control. And it's just a matter of first starting with yourself, right? You know, healing begins at home. But figure out your own complexities and then expand those behaviors out to everyone else. Give everybody a common definition around how to simplify things and have them attack their work every single time using that definition and mindset.
So let's talk a little bit about that mindset. So your book, Why Simple Wins, and again, we will put a link in the show notes so people can go out and get it because it is a great book. Talk about what that mindset
sure.
looks like.
These are, you know, the thing, again, that really drives complexity is it's everyday tasks that we put in place to manage the organization. And at the most basic level, it's human behavior. It's risk, fear, power, and control. So to be a leader of simplicity, or to be your own, what I like to call chief simplicity officer, you need to have a few basic skills. The first one is courage. You really need to have a courage to say no, to let go, to have a subtractive mindset. That's a key thing. The second one is just operate like a minimalist, right? Get rid of, constantly spring clean. Rather, when you add one thing to the to-do list, what are you taking off? How can you delegate? How can you say no? Being a minimalist is key. The other thing is being results-oriented. It's not about action. It's about outcome. So that's where the people have a problem when they do that T-chart exercise. Lots of action on the left-hand side, but very little outcome and meaningful work. So they have to be very results-oriented. And then the other thing I would just say is focus, because it's really easy, especially in times of good, in times of plenty. Well, we've got the money. Let's do a special project. Well, we've got this, you know, we have an opportunity to add a new feature. Why not do it? And what it does is that distracts us from the core focus of what we're trying to achieve. So I would really question before starting a new program, is it getting us to what we want to achieve? Does it keep us focused on our mission? And if it doesn't, we'll do it.
I want to loop back to what you said about it's not about the action, it's about the outcome. I think that is so important, and I'm very outcome-driven, sometimes maybe too much. Sometimes I need to back up and say, what do I need to do to get there? But I think that, to kind of to your point, that really is the difference between kind of what are those day-to-day things you're doing and what are you really trying to achieve. How do you shift that? Like, will you give us an example in your work of how you put that into practice? Because I think it's one of those things that's sounds great, and then people actually have a hard time with it.
So this gets into basically time versus value equation. That's really what we're getting down to, which is, you know, are you spending your time on the things that drive the most value? So, for example, that's where you have people really audit things like audit their meetings, audit their reports. These are two very tangible things you can do and look at, are these necessary? Are these really getting me to the outcomes that I need, or can we achieve this in a different way? Because what I'm trying to do is eliminate things you do on a daily basis that you think are being used to get you to your outcome, your mission, whatever, and actually they're just getting in the way. So, for example, I have people at Sprint. We had them audit every meeting within one of their groups that they do throughout the year, daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, ad hoc. And we charge them with getting rid of half of them.
Oh, that's
it is
bold.
Because that's what I said. You have to be extreme. You have to be bold. Now, would they get rid of half of them? No, we absolutely knew they wouldn't. But you need a stretch. You need an audacious, outrageous, uncomfortable goal. Because only then will you stretch people to achieve what they did, which is they got rid of 18% of their meetings. And just to give you a flavor for what that meant, every single person got back at least 2 hours of time a week just by doing that.
It is huge.
And that's just one thing. And you can do that right now. I mean, like, that's something everyone listening can do that. Your own meetings, your team meetings, your small group meetings. You can keep it in your sphere of influence and control. You don't have to, worry about going to your boss half the time. The other thing is with reports. I mean, list all the reports that you do and say, does this really matter? What if I didn't? And how force yourself to get rid of half of that. And again, with these audacious goals, are you going to get rid of half? No. But what if you got rid of one? Everything is making you focus on the valuable work.
I love that. It reminds me of the visual I get is like a rubber band that you got to stretch it too far to actually get it to the place that you want it to be. And I think sometimes when you position it that way, people are allowed to remove the handcuffs and think bigger as well, and not just, I'll just get rid of this one thing. I'll get rid of these 10 things. I want to flip gears for a second and talk about, so you remove complexity, you get to this simplification mindset, and you put that into practice. What happens to innovation inside companies when you hit that place?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, one first thing is that they're energized. Like, people are excited to think and to do better work because they're focused on mission versus on mundane. So that's number one. And so you give just this mindset and this culture where people are looking to do and feel like they have permission to do these bigger things. The second thing is they have the time. So now the time that they used to spend doing internal checkpoint, cover your ass kind of things, now they spend that time doing external, customer focused, come up with new idea, revenue generating kinds of things. So that's just kind of like a broad stroke kind of example. I'll tell you, there's an example we talk about in the book at Merck, where they literally, once they audited and got rid of a whole bunch of meetings, reports, and emails, they noticed that their innovation pipeline was suddenly growing by more than 10%. And it wasn't mandated, time to come up with some ideas. People were just doing it on their own. That became part of the DNA versus meetings and emails. They filled a void.
That is so big. One of my big frustrations with companies is, innovation is relegated to that 3 p.m. brainstorm with the scented markers and the blank easel pads. And, don't get me wrong, I love scented markers. They're like corporate crack. They're great. But, innovation shouldn't be in that point in time exercise at that certain time. And to your point, half the people shuffle in with no energy to think differently to begin with. And what I hear you saying is that when you simplify, the ability to innovate becomes second nature to people because they have the energy and probably more of the enthusiasm.
They do.
Too.
And this gets back to, yes, people want inspiring work environments, but if they don't have inspiring work, it doesn't matter. So that's what I say about cultures. I want to know, here's a little interesting tidbit about how do I know a good culture. If I look at an employee survey at a company, and we just did this with a large pharmaceutical company, and we looked at their annual survey, and they were doing really well on the metric of, do we have an innovative culture? And I thought, that's interesting. Well, maybe they do in their drug pipeline, but if you look around, it certainly doesn't seem very innovative. And that's, why was I called in then? and I think it's just become one of those things to say, yeah, we're innovative because everyone wants to seem innovative. But the metric that they ranked the lowest on was ability to get things done. And that is
Can't really have both,
can you? And that's the thing, which is if they had a good data analyst in there, they would have looked for that and said, what's the causality there? Which is how can the thing that is bothering people the most is ability to get things done, but you say you have an innovative culture. So there's a gap between perceived and real. And so I look at ability to get things done as the major driver for an innovative culture.
Well, and you said it too in the beginning of the story, which is it's that and it's innovation isn't just your new products or your new services. It's how you think differently, which should span across everything. So we've talked a lot about, how to strip the complexity away. Have you ever, or do you have any case studies of organizations that you've worked with or gone into and thought, wow, they're doing these things right? And what are those things?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, actually, I talk about quite a few in the book. I mean, one that I thought was really interesting, I'll talk about a small level to a big level. I mean, you've got people like Google that just established on a very small level rogue groups that have cut the crap committees. And what that says to me is, right, you need a range of informal and formal things, basically, to get this done. It depends on your culture, how you work. One size does not fit all is what I'm trying to say. And that's why, in my book and in the tools that we offer, we have a toolkit that goes with the book. We try and give everybody kind of a smorgasbord so they can try things, start doing it in their sphere of control, and then roll it out based on their culture. So that's my long way of saying cut the crap committees is one way to do it. Merck actually established a simplification team and a rotating chief simplification officer in their Canada office. So that's a more structured way of doing it. HP and Tesco both looked at their pipelines and said, what can we get rid of? How can we get rid of, quote, zombie projects that we never get rid of because we don't want to hurt people's feelings? We're just not sure. How can we do that to be more decisive and get more focused? So there's a few different ways different companies are doing things. Each of them have different purposes and focus, but the goal of each of those companies is to make simplification a habit.
I have to imagine, too, that with a chief simplification officer, and I love the idea that it's rotating, but there also needed to be a little bit of a come to reality around, if you're going to do that, you need to give those people permission to actually make some changes. Because, you know, I'm sure you see this all the time with innovation in particular, and I think with simplification even more so, because you're asking people to really change how they do things every day. It's one thing to say, yeah, this is great, let's do it, and another thing to give people the actual permission and resources to make it happen.
Exactly. And it's funny because, so we just launched this Killing Complexity Bootcamp. And it's interesting. We started calling it, by the way, our Simplicity Bootcamp. And people didn't really like that. But as soon as we called it Killing Complexity, they were all in.
We like to move away from pain. That sounds good.
We like to get help me solve this pain problem. So the reason I'm telling you this is that when people come in, we have them do a, this is one of my favorite things, a code of conduct. We have them as a team or as a, you know, a cohort. You know, sometimes it's a leadership development group at a certain level in the company. And say, if you could create a simplification code of conduct, what would be on it? What are the behaviors you like more of, right? The behaviors that you're empowered to say no, that you don't have to respond to a email within 24 hours. And what are the behaviors that you want less of? Like you want less people creating false deadlines. You want less people using jargon in their emails, right? So there's good behaviors and bad behaviors. And what they come up with is so telling in terms of where their pain points are in terms of human behavior. And it really helps them unearth the things that drive them crazy every single day and then commit as a team. What are the things we're going to do to really make simplification, one, a habit, and two, if I'm a leader, to empower and even mandate my team to start doing. Like saying no is a big one. People want to do it, but they don't feel empowered to do it. And in fact, a lot of bosses, you'll hear them say, I tell people to say no and they won't do it. They're afraid they're going to get fired or punished. So I have to be the one first to be that role model. And that's really important that the leader role models the behavior or people won't do it. It's too ingrained in them to fall into that complexity trap.
Yeah, you know, saying no is one of the hardest things, yet the most freeing once you actually do it. It's amazing what you get back by doing
that. The biggest thing we help people overcome is fear. What if I don't? What would happen if I actually don't do this? And we have them take it in baby steps, like break things down into parts, do something small to start with, do something that isn't necessarily tied to a business goal. Maybe it's just a funny business cultural thing. Pilot getting rid of something, and then come back and agree whether that was a good move or not. So you're taking away that risk and fear to get them to start to realize, maybe I don't need to do that so much.
So this may be a naive question. When people call you because they're ready for simplification, what is their pain? Is it because they're trying to be more innovative? Is it because, you know, a competitor swept in and, you know, taken market share? What's their reason for calling you to begin with?
All of the above. Like they're falling behind from a competitor. They're not able to get new ideas out the door. People are busy, but exhausted, and it doesn't feel like they're moving the needle at all. What's wrong? So the first thing they start to do is blame we're in a regulated industry. We're a large company. We're overly complex. And my reaction to every company that comes to me is, hey, congratulations. You're like everyone else.
Good for you, being unique like everyone.
You're unique like everyone else. And they feel there's a sense of, you know, smarminess, you know, like you're being a little funny, but of comfort as well. Like they're not that unique. These things are really human behaviors. And the good news is that you can control many of these things and you can do it on an individual level. This isn't something that has to be approved by the CEO, you know, although a cultural mandate to simplify is a good thing, but you can start doing this on your own level. We want to teach each individual person how to be their own chief simplicity officer and get comfortable with those things like, what if I didn't, saying no and getting rid of and operating with subtraction in mind.
So let's bring it back to kind of how you started. You had said this was a quest both personally and professionally to solve a challenge that you mm-hmm. were having. So what are some ways that you have put simplification into practice in your work and life?
Oh, gosh, so many. So I have to tell you, it was easier for me at work than personal life because, you know, personal is personal. You know, I'm hurting personalities. And again, at my work, I'm the boss. So I fully know that, you know, when I make a decision, I can. So, you know, versus when...
You talk to me, myself, and I.
Yeah,
and
I look in the mirror and hope that that's the truth. So a few things that I'll do. The first thing personally, let's start there, is I have done a T-chart for myself and looked at what I've done and really forced myself to commit to getting rid of things on the left-hand side. So that the first thing is, you know, you have to start with yourself. I also, I ask a lot about, is it necessary? And what if I didn't? And that's really helpful for me with things like, in my personal life, kids' carpools and sports, not going, you know, signing up for three different teams, not having to participate in that bake sale again because I feel guilty, that kind of stuff I'm talking about, like, as a mom. And I also pilot saying no to things. Like, maybe I don't need to renovate this part of, I don't know, my kitchen right now. Maybe I can not go on this trip for another couple of months. We can kind of simplify things. And in my work, I'll tell you, the best thing I can get my team and myself to do is getting rid of rules and questioning assumptions. We assume there are certain ways we have to work. We assume standard business practices, and that makes us fall into a rut, even though we think we're in a groove. And it's very hard to tell the difference sometimes between a groove and a rut. And so one of the things that we've institutionalized here at my company is called Kill a Stupid Rule. And it's so institutionalized now, we just do it. We don't have to sit down and do it annually, or we meet biannually to go over our annual plan and strategy development. And what I do is I ask people to give me their rules that they think are holding us back from being a better company. And I am shocked with what they come up with. And the reason why I'm shocked is often the rules they come up with are the ones I created.
Well, I had to come from somewhere.
Yeah, well, I'm the boss, so of course I'm the one that comes up with all the stupid rules. But I'm, and it's true. That's what happens if you do this and you're a boss. Put your armor on, because the things people will come up with are the things you created. But some of them have outlived their time, and my team's right. Some of them are stupid because I don't do that actual work. So I don't know how it really works. I'm just trying to put a process in place to make things operate smoothly. And in fact, I'm doing the opposite. So it's important to talk to the people doing the work and ask them what we can get rid of, because then that also segues into a conversation of what can we do better.
If you were to tell someone kind of the one reason why they should pick up your book, and the reason that, you know, it's not going to just be yet another book on the shelf of books I never finished, what would that reason be? And just for everyone out there, the book is called Why Simple Wins. Again, it's fantastic. I'll put it in the show notes, but I'd love to hear your perspective on why we should pick it up.
I mean, first of all, we don't realize the amount of complexity we're drowning in. And we also don't realize the power we have to change it. And I think there are things in the book, there's even a chapter dedicated to it, that can make them see the tactics that they can start trying immediately when reading it to make a difference in their life and get time back for the things that matter. And what matters is up to the reader. You know, that might be spending more time with your kids. It might be getting a pet. It might be doing volunteer work. It might be getting a promotion because you were able to come up with that really kick-ass idea that before you couldn't do because you were drowning in emails all night long.
Oh, midnight emails. Those are the worst. Where should people find you online? Where would you like them to go to learn more?
Well, obviously, to get the book, go to Amazon. There's the book, and there's the toolkit, too. I'm pretty proud of the toolkit because we wanted to make the tools available so people could do it with their teams or themselves and become that chief learning officer. Or come to my website, which is futurethink.com, and you can see in there, you can get access to, if they'd like, all of our simplification resources online. We actually give access to them through a small membership, and that gives people downloadable tools and videos, not longer than 2 minutes each, that they can just kind of get a tip or technique every week just to try something new.
That's great. I think it's important to have that focus on tools as well. I can't tell you the number of ideas that I've come across and be like, that's great. And then I'm just left with like, well,
how do I do it? I don't have time to do that. So that's what there are a bajillion great ideas that never see the light of day, not because they're good, but because we didn't have time to get them done.
Yeah. So Lisa, what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you? It's, you know, passion, hobby, experience.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Let's see. I am an avid traveler, not just because of my work, but I really believe, especially for my children, to stamp that passport. I want them to get out and see the world. And so I have been to, 50 countries, and last year, all 50 states. That was a pretty big one for me. Yeah, North Dakota, South Dakota. And the woman at the rental car, this is funny, we got off the plane in North Dakota, and we were driving down to South Dakota because that's how I was going to check this thing off the list. And I get up to the Hertz counter and I said, hey, can I rent a convertible? You know, fun fact, no convertibles in North Dakota. But she said, let me guess, we're your 50th state, aren't we? And I said,
oh my God.
She goes, nobody else comes here. You know, she's, and I said, actually, no, you're my 49th. Once I hit South Dakota, it'll be 50th. She high-fived me and gave me a discount. So I was really excited about that.
That's when you know you're the 50th state.
Know. Unless you're fracking, you're the 50th state. Right.
Right, right. Oh my gosh. We were actually just in South Dakota last weekend.
Oh, so fun.
We're hitting the Badlands and Mount Rushmore and all those things.
Isn't it great? That's the other thing is people say, you know, well, not everybody can travel. You get to do that for your work. And I said, no, wait a minute. I'm not saying go abroad. I'm saying, you know, this is a big country and it's an awesome country. Yeah. You know, get to the states and the national parks are great.
They're so great. And, you know, so we always traveled internationally. My family is originally from Israel and we grew up in the Bay Area. So you just flew everywhere international.
Yeah.
But I've now come to realize how many amazing things are right in our backyard and really driving distance away, not always short. I don't do well in cars, so anything beyond 3 hours to me is hard, but I do it because it's all really right there.
It is.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. So that's great. I think you and I align. Getting out and like seeing the world is amazing.
Yeah. It's. I think it also, you know, just to kind of loop it back, I think it leads to innovative thinking because you understand people from different perspectives and experiences.
You just nailed it. You know, I it's funny. One of the things I'll tell you I said about my children, when I first took my son on his first trip, he wanted to go to Spain with me because he, of course, likes football, soccer. And he started to, when we were on the trip, I noticed something funny he was doing. And whenever we would go to a new restaurant or, you know, a new cultural experience or, you know, meet somebody that spoke a different language, he said to me, you know, especially when he was eating something odd, Mom, this is really weird. And I said, Jack, you know, one of the things you can't say the word weird when you're with Mom. Because, you know, why do you think it's weird? And he said, because it's not how we do it. And I said, you know, when people look at you and see how you act, they think you're weird. And he looked at me like, that is not possible.
I'm not weird.
And I said, so from now on, you got to look at things as different. And I will tell you, it changed his perspective.
Yeah. Have you seen, random side note, but the Derek Sivers little, I think it was a TED or something, 3 minute different versus weird? Oh, I'll send it to you later. It's fantastic. It highlights exactly what you're saying. Like, is that different, weird, or is it just different?
Oh, I've never heard that. Darn it. I hope, did he get that from me or me from him?
I think great minds think alike.
Let's go with that. That's great.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, this has been phenomenal. Thank you so much. Really, I've gathered a lot. I have circled my little T. I'm going to go do some simplification actions now.
Oh, good. Well, listen, you're a wonderful interviewer, and thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.